The memory of Simchat Beit HaShoeva, the festival of the water drawing on Sukkot, would have remained with Jews after the Second Temple period. They would have recalled how it marked the most joyous moment of the Jewish year. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 119, Sukkot on the Mount. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. To the great and elevated nation of the Jews, from the priest and head of the Galilee, many greetings. Ye shall know that the time of the dispersion of our people is at an end, and from now onwards the day of our congregation and salvation has come, for the Roman kings have written a decree to hand over our city of Jerusalem to us. Therefore, come quickly to Jerusalem for the coming holiday of Sukkoth, for our kingdom is established in Jerusalem. As reported in a 6th century Christian biography, cited by the historian Moshe Gil, this was the message sent at some point in the first part of the 5th century from the Jews of the Holy Land to their brethren in the diaspora. The moment marked another expression of hope by the Jewish people that they might finally be allowed to return to Jerusalem in a permanent way. These hopes were dashed, but a return to this tale provides us perspective on how much has changed in our own age and also on what is yet to be experienced. As we mentioned, the negative attitude taken by the Emperor Theodosius II to the Jewish faith could be contrasted with that of his wife Eudocia, who, perhaps because of her non-Christian background, had a different attitude to the non-Christian communities in the empire. Upon arriving in the sacred city of Jerusalem in 438, the empress was inspired by the Bible to build walls for Jerusalem. Upon arriving in the sacred city of Jerusalem in 438, the empress was inspired by the Bible to fix Jerusalem's walls, and knowing her open-mindedness, the Jewish community in the Holy Land appealed to her for the opportunity to celebrate a Jewish festival at a site that embodied the locus of their longing. A summary of what unfolded is provided by Bar Ilan University's Meir Lowenfeld. Quote, Eudocia decided in 438 to go on a pilgrimage to the Holy Land in order to strengthen her position at the court and regain her husband's confidence. On her way to Jerusalem, Eudocia was greeted in every city by the pagan and Jewish population, even while the Christians tended to ignore her visit. The pagans saw in her one of their own, who had succeeded in advancing to the highest position in the empire, while many Jews viewed her as a messenger of the redemption which they believed to be at hand. While traveling in the Galilee, she met with the leading rabbis of the region. They asked her for permission to ascend the Temple Mount once again, something that Jews had been forbidden to do for a very long time, except once a year on Tisha B'Av, the day commemorating the destruction of the Holy Temple. She immediately agreed with the rabbis and issued a proclamation to this effect. Great excitement gripped the Jews of the area, who saw in this edict another sign of the proximity of the final redemption. The rabbis sent letters to Jewish communities throughout the world, informing them of the good news and asking them to come on pilgrimage to Jerusalem on the coming Sukkot festival. End quote. Pondering this, it may seem curious at first that it would have been Sukkot, of all holidays, that would have been the centerpiece of the Jewish request to mark their return to the Temple Mount. But we can explain this by pointing out again that throughout much of the periods of the First and Second Temple, Sukkot was the premier annual moment when a renewal of the Jewish connection to the temple took place. As many note, Solomon selected the Sukkot season as the time when he originally inaugurated the temple that he had built, and Ezra as well, describing the beginnings of the offerings on the altar in the Second Temple period under the leadership of Zerubbabel, lists the month of Tishrei, the month of the Sukkot festival, as the one in which these celebrations took place. Throughout much of the First Temple period, and it seems throughout at least parts of the Second Temple period as well, Sukkot was the supreme holiday of the temple. It was on Sukkot that all Israel streamed to the temple. It was on Sukkot that all Israel spent a great deal of time in the temple. It was on Sukkot that Jews truly comprehended the meaning and experience of the temple. Now, one might ask, of course, isn't Pesach, Passover, more central to our identity? And given the seriousness of the obligation of the Paschal sacrifice, shouldn't Passover have been the holiday throughout the First Temple period when all Israel streamed to the temple? Perhaps yes, but the hard truth is that it seems from the Bible that this was not always the case. Thus, we are informed in Kings that when Josiah, one of the last monarchs of the Davidic house, gathered all Israel for Passover, the Bible emphasizes that a Passover of that level of observance had not occurred in a long time. And the reason is linked perhaps to the fact that biblical Israel was an agricultural society. And, as the Bible makes clear, throughout much of the First Temple period, for at least some Jews, not every aspect of the Torah was entirely observed or embraced. Pesach and Shavuot, Passover, and Pentecost take place during the farming season, and therefore many might have had the incentive to stay home. And even for those who were fully observant of biblical law, they might have come to Jerusalem for one day, bringing the Paschal sacrifice and then going back to their farms. Indeed, Nachmanides writes that the reason that the holiday of Shavuot, Pentecost, is only one day rather than seven is because it occurs in the throes of agricultural engagement, when even devout farmers could not spare more than one day off. But Sukkot falls out after all the harvesting is done. The farmers have yet to plant, and therefore everyone was able to come to Jerusalem. Recall how the sins of Jeroboam began when this first ruler of the northern kingdom sought to prevent his subjects from journeying to Jerusalem to mark Sukkot. Sukkot, in other words, was often the supreme gathering of the Jews in Jerusalem, and its status in the first temple period would have impacted the way it was seen in the second temple and beyond. This is why perhaps Sukkot would have been selected not only by Solomon, but also Zerubbabel in the beginning of the second temple age to mark the inauguration of temple ritual, because Sukkot had emerged first and foremost as a holiday of rededication of the national spirit to the temple. Professor Jeffrey Rubinstein puts it this way, quote, Sukkot, after all, was Hechag, the festival, a title found in both biblical and rabbinic sources. The autumnal harvest concluded the agricultural year, and peasants, now free from the arduous labors, could journey to Jerusalem for the celebrations. Although Passover and Shavuot, Pentecost, were also pilgrimages, they occurred in spring and summer, during the middle of the harvest season, and were not as well attended. Josephus, too, distinguishes Sukkot by noting that this festival is observed by us with special care, and that it is especially sacred. Rabbinic accounts of the Sukkot temple rituals, the water libations, the willow procession, the circumnavigations around the altar, Simchat Beit HaShoevah with its dancing, acrobatics, and flaming torches, the recitations of psalms, the waving of lulavs, give sense of the pageantry and splendor that characterized the festival week. The rabbinic remark, he who never saw Simchat Beit HaShoevah, never saw true joy, expresses the impression made by these ceremonies, end quote. Thus, the memory of Simchat Beit HaShoevah, the festival of the water drawing on Sukkot, would have remained with Jews after the Second Temple period. They would have recalled how it marked the most joyous moment of the Jewish year. And as Rubinstein also points out, and as we have discussed in this series, Sukkot celebrations were also at the heart of the Maccabee conquest and rededication of the Temple Mount. We can therefore understand how the Jews in the year 438 would have chosen Sukkot of all holidays to reinvigorate the Jewish connection to Jerusalem for Jews from all around the world. Yet this ascension of the Jews to the Mount was opposed fiercely by a Syrian monk who had come from Syria to Jerusalem, Barsoma of Nisibis, who led a militant group of fellow monks. I cite Simon Sebag Montefiore's summary of what occurred. Quote, now in Jerusalem, Barsoma's Cenobite shock troopers, armed with swords and clubs under monks' robes, ambushed the Jews on the Temple Mount, stoning and killing many of them, tossing their bodies into water cisterns and courtyards. The Jews fought back, arrested 18 attackers, and handed them over to the Byzantine governor, who charged them with murder. Montefiore adds, the mob turned in Barsoma's favor, especially when he cited a timely earthquake as a sign of divine approval. If the empress planned to execute Christians, Barsoma's followers cried, then we will burn the empress and all those with her. Barsoma terrorized officials into testifying that the Jewish victims had no wounds. They had died of natural causes. Another earthquake added to the widespread fear. The city was slipping out of control. Eudocia had little choice but to acquiesce, end quote. Montefiore further describes Eudocia's return to Constantinople and her rivalry with her sister-in-law, Pulcheria, writing that, quote, when Empress Eudocia returned to Constantinople in 439, she brought back several important relics. Reports of her pilgrimage gained her great prestige. With the help of her sword-bearer, she sought to have Pulcheria removed from the court. She had some limited success in this effort. But soon another eunuch turned on Eudocia and engineered her fall by accusing her of committing adultery. Eudocia again was forced to leave the royal court. She headed once more for Jerusalem, but this time her exile was permanent, and she never returned to the imperial capital. At her palaces in Bethlehem and in Jerusalem, she continued to receive petitions from all sections of the population. She sought to alleviate the persecution of Jews, even though such efforts were highly unpopular among contemporary Jerusalem Christians. However, now she no longer had the powers she once had, and her efforts to help the Jews bore only limited success. End quote. As Mayor Loewenberg reflects, this moment seems to have marked the last true full access Jews had to the Temple Mount and Jerusalem until the Persian invasion many years in the future. We can therefore reflect on the wonders of our own age. For today, Sukkot is indeed a holiday when Jerusalem is packed with Jews celebrating the biblical festival. And, fascinatingly, increasingly, these Jews are joined by some Christians from around the world who are inspired by Zechariah's call to the nations of the earth to join the Jews in the Sukkot celebration. Pondering this and reflecting on the story of 438, we can marvel how much has changed, both in terms of Jewish presence in Jerusalem and in the fact that there are non-Jews of faith that celebrate today this Jewish relationship with Jerusalem. But it bears noting again and again that it was always first and foremost the Temple Mount in Jerusalem where Jews sought to worship and pray, and that now there are those around the world and in the Holy Land who oppose any true Jewish access there, in denial of all that history has to teach us about the Jewish connection to that supremely sacred site. In telling the story of Jerusalem, we can both rejoice in all that has occurred in our time and also remain loyal to the dreams of the past while thinking about the Jewish future. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.